Well, I wrote a book that eventually became my autobiography 20 years ago when I was 50, and it was never intended as an autobiography. I didn't feel I was old enough to know anything, but I'd submitted a book of essays, and the editor kept sending them back saying, no, throw that essay out, give us some personal stuff. And in the end, only three of the essays survived, and it became an autobiography, Metamorphosis. But I figure when I hit 70, I should have a few lessons that I'd learned in that life. And I hit 70 in March and thought, okay, I better look back on the life. So I wanted to do a few things. I wanted to draw maybe a few things that would be worth considering out of that life. I also wanted to point out that people like me don't spring into existence and prominence because we're so terrific. The fact is that dozens and dozens and dozens of people go into making it possible for someone like me to gain a certain amount of public profile. When I was starting my first national television program in the early 1970s, I was still an active scientist, and I was we were filming in New Orleans in a lab, and I was sitting on a stool, and I found it unbelievably boring, because first the lighting guy comes in and he adjusts everything and sets a light and takes readings, and this goes on for a long time, and then the sound guy comes and hooks up the mic and adjusts and does what she says, you know, would you mind speaking in, and then the camera assistant comes and sets up the tripod, and then finally the cameraman kind of walks in, and Rudy Kovanec had this annoying habit that he'd come up and put a light meter right in front of my nose, and then he'd go back to the camera and adjust the focus, and another, nothing's changed, but he'd do this 7 or 8 times. And finally I said, Rudy, for Christ's sake, shoot the goddamn thing. And my boss, Jim Murray, grabbed me by the shoulder and pulled me into another room, closed the door. He said, listen, Suzuki, everybody in that room is busting their ass to make you look good, and that's not easy. And that was a very good lesson. I kind of crept back in, you know, feeling all ashamed, because in the end, they shoot it, they edit it, it runs on air, and nobody says, wasn't the lighting great? Or what about the sun? I mean, they all say, wasn't Suzuki's show great? And that's when I realized that all these people are doing their job and making me look good without ever saying I need credit or recognition. And if you read the book, you'll see that the major character there who made my life possible and so much of my work was my wife, but then there have been dozens of others. But the major reason I wrote the book was that environmentalists these days get portrayed as being very depressing. You know, we walk around with a little cloud over our head and it's all doom and gloom, and we're lecturing people about don't do this and don't do that. And what I wanted to do was to show that being an environmental activist means having wonderful experiences, going out in some of the most amazing places and meeting remarkable people, and now and then even getting to celebrate a victory. And I hope that young people especially can be inspired to realize that this is what I wouldn't mind doing for my life. And I'm sure you've been seeing all the reports that have come in the last couple of weeks about the state of the oceans and the cost of global warming. And it really, we're in a very, very terrifying crunch now. And if we don't really start dealing with this as if there are 1,000 Pearl Harbors going off at once, I just fear for our children. Anyway, that's enough pontificating. So I'd just like to grab a few vignettes from my life and share them with you. And for me, it starts here with my mother and father, who were born and raised in Vancouver, Canada. This is March 21st, 1934. And 2 years later, my twin sister, Marcia, and I were born. I love these pictures because you realize how this is antiquity, man. This is way back. But this is Vancouver, and look at the snow. It's something we hardly ever see anymore. A few years later, my beloved younger sister, Aiko, was born, and she just died on New Year's Eve. So for me, it's a great, a tremendous loss. My mother was a typical Japanese-Canadian mother. She was very quiet and reserved. First one up in the morning, last to go to bed at night, and never complained, always worked. And my dad was the one everybody loved because he was outgoing and he was a good storyteller. But as I think back on my life, my mother gave me one of the greatest gifts. When I was older, I fell in love with the swamp, and I would come home covered in mud and soaking wet with jars of turtles and beetles and frogs' eggs. And my mother always acted as if this is the most wonderful thing she could imagine. And she never, ever said, "Don't come in the house, you're going to dirty the floor." She just welcomed me into the house. And it was, and looking back, it was just such an important gift for me. I remember I got this idea I was going to make a fortune by getting dew worms at night and selling them for half a cent a piece to fishermen. And I collected a whole bunch of hundreds of them and put them in a box and shoved them in the fridge. And the next morning I got up, there's my mother sitting on the floor. The worms had crawled all through the fridge and she was pulling them out of the fridge. Not a word of criticism, not a dirty look. That was my mother. My mother gave me the greatest gift. There are seats up here. Come on up. And this is my first memory of from childhood, which is there are seats here too. I was 4 years old, and my father was an avid outdoorsman, a camper, a hiker, and a gardener, and fishing was his great passion. And so, here I am at 4 years old. I'd had my first catch of trout, and I've been hooked on fishing ever since. This is September. I think you can tell from the expression on my sister's face and my face that this is our first day of kindergarten. And so we were very excited to be going, 1941. 3 months later, on December 7th, Japan attacked Pearl Harbor, and our lives were turned upside down. There were about 22,000 Japanese Canadians living on the west coast of British Columbia. Most of them were citizens by naturalization. They were immigrants who had become citizens. About 10-15% were like my parents and my sisters and me, born and raised in Canada. But we looked like the enemy, and we were regarded as a threat to the country. And so, as happened in the United States, we were deprived of all rights of citizenship and shipped off to camps in the Rocky Mountains. And to me, the lesson is that democracy is a great ideal, and you have all these guarantees of equality before the law and freedom of speech and association and movement. Those rights are easy to guarantee when times are easy. The only time those rights matter are when times are tough. And if you can't guarantee them when times are tough, you don't deserve to be called a democracy. Canada, the United States, flunked that test very, very badly. And I feel part of my job today is to remind people of how fragile democracy is. And right now, in the post-9/11 era, I see the same kind of fear happening. And we better remember what happened to the Japanese during the Second World War. We were Canadian-born and raised, and we were treated like enemy aliens. Here's my first class, and of course, everybody there is Japanese. And this is me and Herb Tanaka. Herb and I were the only kids in the whole class whose parents had been born and raised in Canada. All the other kids, their parents had come from Japan. So Herb and I only spoke English. All the other kids were fluently bilingual, and they'd play and switch from Japanese to English to Japanese. Herb and I had no idea what they're talking about. So they naturally picked on Herb and me. So I hated Japanese. The problem was, when I looked in the mirror, that's the guy I hated, right? And when I looked in the mirror, these eyes were what my country was saying were the enemy. And one of the terrible burdens of those years is that after the war, and to this very day, I hate to look at myself on television. I was just watching an old film with my wife the other night, and she said to me, "Do you realize every time you come up on camera, you turn away and you don't look?" I hadn't realized it. But this is the terrible kind of self-loathing that resulted from those years in the war. And when I've learned to live with that. But when I think of First Nations people, Native Canadians, who were taught they were savages for over 100 years, you think about the impact of that on their lives and their children. Fortunately, I didn't want to play with these other kids then, because they treated me badly. I didn't like them. But we were in the Rocky Mountains, and you didn't have to play with the kids. We could go fishing. So this is not my dad. This is a neighbor here. But this is a 12-kilometer hike up a mountain. And it's now a part of a provincial park. I've gone back there several times in the last few years. It's every bit as beautiful and filled with fish. Pardon? No, this is in British Columbia. It's called Valhalla Provincial Park. When the war was coming to an end, British Columbia saw a way to get rid of Japanese. They said, you can sign up, give up your citizenship, and we'll give you a one-way ticket to Japan, or you go east of the Rockies and get out of the province. And because, although most of the people in the camps were Canadians by citizenship, they were so angry at the government, they tried to get everybody to sign up to leave Canada. And over 95% of the people in the camps did. But my mom and dad said, we've never been to Japan. That's a foreign country. We're staying. And so we ended up in Ontario. We ended up in the center of Canada. And the beauty of Ontario in 1945, this was in farming country, was that pesticides still were not extensively used. So there were insects everywhere. And insects became one of my great passions to this very day. And insects, again, were this wonderful way of making connection with the natural world. This is a snapping turtle. Do you have snappers in California? These animals are very dangerous. We used to get them as big as a washtub like this, and those could take off your hand with one bite. And the reason we were catching them is we were impoverished by the war. This was meat for us. We ate them. Now, we lived in a rural agricultural community for 4 years in southern Ontario. But when I got to the high school, my dad was very concerned. He felt the way to get out of our poverty was education, and he wanted to have better access to schools. So we moved to London, Ontario, which at that time was a city of 70,000 people. It's over 300,000 today. And by the time I got to London, I was already in full-blown post-puberty, and I was just nuts about girls. Now, the problem was I'd been scarred by the war. There was no way I would ever ask a white girl out. And my dad called me in one day and said, I know that you want to date girls, but I want you to know the only acceptable girl for you is Japanese. And I said, Dad, there are only 10 Japanese girls in London, and three of them are my sisters. So, okay, he said, if you find a Chinese girl, that's okay with me. Dad, there are only three Chinese families in London. I don't know. Okay, if you find a native girl, an Indian girl, that's okay. I said, Dad, I don't even know where the reservation is. I've never met a native girl. Okay, if you find a black girl, that's okay with me. So I said, the only girl I knew was Annabelle Johnson, and I would love to go out with her, but she wasn't interested in me. Okay, if you find a Jewish girl, that's okay with me. So he had this very definite hierarchy that he was willing to slide down, but absolutely unacceptable, rock bottom, you're kicked out of the house if you go out with an English girl. And my second wife is English, so I'll tell you more about that later. But he didn't have to worry about me dating other girls because I was too scarred by the war to ask any white girl out. And so I basically ran around horny as a teenager, not able to do anything. But in London, the great thing is you can go fishing. So I was 14. This is a carp. White people, this is caught in the Thames River, which of course runs through London in Ontario. I know white people think of carp as a trash fish, but Asians have nothing but respect for carp, and we caught them and we ate them. Now, when I tell people in London today we ate all the fish that came out of the Thames, they go, oh my God, you must glow at night, because the Thames is so polluted that nobody would eat anything that comes out of the river. But when I, in 1949, when we moved to London, it was a very, very rich area. My dad always felt that Asians had a real impediment, that we're very shy in public. And he said, if you want to succeed in Canada, you got to be able to get up on your feet and speak. And so he made me enter public speaking contests. I don't know if you have them anymore in the States, but they were all the rage in the 50s, oratorical contests. And I won a lot of public speaking contest because my dad just trained me to be a public speaker, and it was always one of the great gifts that he gave me, although I hated it at the time. In high school, I suffered from not only poverty, but the terrible impediment was that I was smart. And in high school, in the 50s, they used to call people like me brains because we got good grades. And if you were a brain, it was like having syphilis. I mean, it was just a terrible, terrible impediment. And you know that in high school, the students divide up into two groups. There are the innies and the outies. The innies are the kids that they play basketball, football, hockey, the cheerleaders, and they set the social seem, and then the outies are everybody else, the brains, people in drama club, in glee club, in debate club, and that was all of us. And in my senior year in high school, some kids said, why don't you run for president? And so I, isn't that a great car? That was my family car, 1929 Model A Ford. And so dad let me use the family car for this. What I did is I appealed to the outies. I said, I'm not one of the beautiful people. I'm not a jock, but I'm an outie, but vote for me. And I discovered a very important thing, which is people's power. There are way more outies than innies. I got more votes than all the other candidates combined. And because my dad emphasized grades and going to school, I had a good academic record, and I was offered a scholarship to an outstanding school in the States called Amherst College. And we were impoverished by the war, but Amherst had a policy that I've always been grateful to them for. They believed that foreign students added to the education of American students, and they regarded foreigners coming in as an important addition to the school. And I've taught at the University of British Columbia for 40 years, and we gouge foreign students. We charge Chinese and Japanese students top prices just to get their money, and it fills me with shame to belong to a university like that. But Amherst valued us. They offered me a scholarship that was worth more than my father made in a year, which in 1954 was $1,500. But thanks to that scholarship, I got to go and get an education I couldn't get in Canada. And Amherst, my dad never believed in sports. He always thought it was frivolous. So he said, you do your work at school. When you're finished, you come home, do the chores, and then you do your homework. And Amherst believed that to be a well-rounded person, you had to do sports as well as academics. And they made us go out for teams. And so I discovered the joy of athletics, which has lasted all my life. So I'm grateful to Amherst for both the academics and the sports. I graduated in 1958 from Amherst, and I had discovered there was not a bad-looking girl in London that was Japanese. And so 1958, I married her. Is Joanne, and our idea was I'd go to... Oh, I had been accepted to medical school at the University of Western Ontario, which is in London. And I was all set to go, but I fell madly in love with genetics. And so at the last minute, I turned down the medical position in medical school and went to graduate school. And my mother wept for months. She couldn't figure out how I could give up the opportunity to become a medical doctor so I could study fruit flies. But that's what I did. I went to the University of Chicago, and this is my boss, Bill Baker, grad student. And these vials and bottles are filled with hundreds and hundreds of fruit flies that have to be separated and classified. And to my shock and delight, we immediately had a baby. Our plan was not to have children until I was a professor in a university. But of course, 5 months after we were married, she was pregnant. And I discovered the greatest experience of my life, which was to be a father. And without question, that has been for my entire life the great joy of my life. But now I had to get out of there in a hurry. Joanne could only work half time. And so I finished up my degree in less than 3 years and got a job at Oak Ridge National Laboratories in Tennessee. And this is kind of a grainy picture. It's a publicity still, foreign doctor studying fruit flies. And Oak Ridge is where, under the Manhattan Project in World War II, uranium was purified for the bombs that were dropped over Hiroshima and Nagasaki. But after the war, they converted the labs into research labs, and the biology division had the top genetics group in the world. And for me, it was a great thrill to be able to go and work there. This is the guy I worked with, Dan Lindsley, who's now professor at UC San Diego, UCSD. And when I was there, this man, Professor Tazima, visited from Japan. He's a world expert on silkworm genetics. And I almost took his offer to go to Japan and try to apply the genetics of fruit flies to the study of silkworms. But in the end, I turned it down. Oak Ridge was a wonderful place to learn and do science. But Oak Ridge in 1950, 60, one when I went was still segregated. And many of my friends in the lab were black, but they couldn't use the laundromats, go to the movies, or go to the churches with white people in Oak Ridge. And I just decided I didn't want to live in a country that allowed that to go on. Now, I knew that what they'd done to us during the war, to Japanese Canadians, but I felt Canada was smaller and that there was a chance to make some changes. So I left Oak Ridge and came back to Canada. The first job I got, the University of Alberta, in 1962. And two things happened to me there that were very, very important. The first was the university had its own television program on a local community channel. And somehow someone heard that I was a good teacher and they asked me to do one and they loved it. And I ended up doing 8 programs. And that planted a seed way back in 1962 that, gee, this is a potentially powerful way of educating a large number of people. And it eventually led to a second career in television. The other thing, though, that was the most important thing, just as I was beginning my career, and I was hot, you know, we knew about DNA and genes, and we knew about the codons and all this stuff, and I was going to set out and make my name as a scientist. And in 1962, a woman named Rachel Carson published Silent Spring. And it changed my life. It's hard to imagine what it was like in 1962. When her book came out, there wasn't a single department or minister of the environment in any government on the planet. In 1962, the environment was not an issue. But Rachel Carson put it on the map. And to me, as I read the book, it was as if she'd written it to me. The book said, you scientists are clever. You know, you can make something like DDT and show it kills insects and doesn't hurt plants. But you forget that the lab is not the real world. I had always thought when I do work in the lab, it's a miniature replica of the world. So we study it in the lab and then we extrapolate to the real world. And what Rachel Carson said is, you take a part of nature and you bring it in the lab and you remove it from the context in which it exists. You lose sight of the rhythms and the patterns that it's a part of. So what you're studying is an artifact. It's got nothing to do with the real world. And for me, that was just a huge insight. And I was pulled still had a career in science, but it pulled me out into the environmental movement. And I'm ashamed to say that most geneticists and biotechnologists today haven't understood Rachel Carson's message. You can study things in the lab, but it doesn't help you predict what those manipulations will do out in the real world. And that's the great danger of that kind of work. Well, that year in Edmonton, if you look at a map, Edmonton, where this university is very far north. It was 40 below zero for a month. And I just said, human beings shouldn't live under these conditions. I'm out of here. Job came up at you. University of British Columbia, and I left after a year, and here I am then setting up my lab at, this is Edmonton. I went to the University of British Columbia and started a lab, and I got so wrapped up in the lab. I was living at the lab 7 days a week, and not surprisingly, my marriage broke up in the mid-60s. And one of the great gifts that Joanne gave me was that we both agreed that our children were the result of our love for each other. And we would never, ever use the children to punish or hurt the other partner. And that was just wonderful. I could walk in and see the kids. I'd walk in around dinner time and catch a meal because I can't cook. And Joanne often came camping with us, and we still existed as a family. I was offered a job in the mid-60s in the Department of Genetics at Berkeley. And that was so flattering to me. I mean, here I am from the boonies of Canada, and they're offering me a job. And I said, well, gee, I wanted to live in Canada, but let me come down and teach for a quarter and see if you still like me. And if I like Berkeley, I'll come down. And I went down right at the time People's Park broke out. I'm sure you all remember people right. And the campus was gassed twice while I was there. They killed a boy. And it was just a frightening time for me. And I said, I'm out of here. So when I left, I taught for a quarter and I turned down the job. But when I came back, I had undergone a bit of a change. And this, I always thank Berkeley for that. And this is what I was like when I started my first television program called Suzuki on Science, and scientists hated it. They absolutely hated it because I was a scientist, but I looked like a hippie. But the young people liked it, and the show did very, very, very well. Of course, as soon as I got to BC, I was up camping as often as I could, and this is in the upper reaches in the alpine area of an area, a valley called the Stein Valley, which later became a huge area of confrontation over logging practices. But this is British Columbia, the way I know it, as this just amazing province of wilderness. But as soon as we, within a few months after I was camping in the mountains, this is what I began to encounter everywhere I went. This is considered proper forestry practice. This clear cut is not just a matter of a few dozen hectares. This is kilometers long, this area here. And foresters say, oh yeah, it doesn't look good when you first cut it, but in a few years it greens up and it doesn't look too bad. Well, this mountain here was clear cut. You can see way back in there, all of this is clear cut. But look what happens when you drive roads in here. You get avalanche after avalanche, and the soil is very thin. When you get a slide like this, you expose rock. You know that the forest will never grow back. Yeah, there are green things growing, but you'll never have a forest like the one that you cut down. And of course, the biggest victims of this kind of forestry practice are animals like this. I took this picture down in the estuaries in a great watershed that was going to be logged. Grizzly bears need hundreds of kilometers, especially the males need hundreds of kilometers to roam every year, and we just aren't willing to give them that. So this is the kind of issue that I was swept up in British Columbia then, the battle against clear-cut logging and pulp mill pollution and so on. So I had been single for 6 years in 1971 when I was invited to give a lecture at the University of Carleton University in Ottawa in December. And I went, and the room was packed. There were about 400 kids packed in this room, sitting in the aisles and the stairs in the back. And as I began to speak, I noticed this one woman sitting there, and it was just like there was a spotlight on her. So naturally, I tried to give the best speech I could possibly give. And at the end of the talk, most people were leaving, and some people came up to the front, and she was one of them. So now my brain is going 100 miles an hour, and it's saying, how the hell do you pick up a white woman? Like, I had no idea. You know, I watch guys go in a bar and pick up women, and I could never figure out how they do it. So I was kind of tongue-tied. And finally I said, well, I got to go now. I hope you're all coming to the party tonight. And I left. And I didn't tell them where it was, what time, how to get there, nothing. And fortunately, she got the message and was there. And so we were married exactly a year to the day after we met in 1972. And of course, I was now in seventh heaven. I'd met the woman of my life. She was beautiful. She was 10 times smarter than me. And she was actually nice. So that was great. So I was shocked a year later when she came to me and said, you know, I love being married to you, but I really have to finish my education and I have to go on. She was, when I met her, she was a master's student in comparative literature. And it was a very painful thing for both of us, but I said, look, don't go to UBC so you can live in Vancouver with me. Go to the best university you can go to in your area, and I'll support you. And she went to the University of Wisconsin in Madison. And for 2 years, we commuted. And it was very, very painful. You know, when you're young and in love, 2 years is a long time. But 2 years goes by. And of course, when you get to be 70, 2 years seems like nothing. But it was, I think, in the end, our marriage was so much stronger for having lived through that. And soon, not only was she back in Vancouver working on her thesis, but she worked on a project with us, our first child together, Severn, and a few years later, this is of course she's a committed feminist, and when you marry a feminist, you got no choice, right? You got to try to look like one anyway. So not only do you carry your baby, but the important thing is don't forget the laundry basket. You got to do your share. And soon she had a PhD, and if you could look a little further down, you'd see she had our second experiment, Sarika, already going. This, for those of you that have been to Vancouver, you might recognize, this is through the dining room window of our house. We live right on English Bay on the ocean, and this is Vancouver over here. And this dark area here is Stanley Park. And then there's a bridge across, Lionsgate Bridge, and then there's West Vancouver, North Vancouver. So we live in what I think is the most beautiful city in North America. And as soon as Tara got her PhD, it was a really magnificent thesis. She was offered a job teaching writing at Harvard, which she did. She accepted. And for 6 years, we would move to Toronto in September, where I would take care, I'd do my television work in Toronto, and she would commute down to Boston during the week. It's been very, very difficult being a feminist and trying to balance family and career and all that. But Tara managed to do that very well. In the late 70s, I decided to do a film for The Nature of Things about a battle over logging in the Queen Charlotte Islands, which is an archipelago coming off the panhandle of Alaska, northwest corner of British Columbia. And when I went up there and filmed it, it changed my life.
The vast forests of Canada are more than just a potential source of revenue. They're part of the spiritual mystique of the country. I'm on Windy Bay in the Queen Charlotte Islands off the coast of British Columbia. And this virgin forest began its existence over 8,000 years ago. These trees were already mature adults long before Christopher Columbus discovered America. It was here that the Haida Indians hunted and fished. They used these trees to build their totems, their dugouts, and their longhouses. It was these trees that inspired Emily Carr to paint some of her most haunting pictures. Yet having existed for thousands of years, this forest could disappear in a matter of months through logging. Tonight we take a look at a special issue that affects all Canadians and that asks us to redefine the very notion of progress.
Our people have determined that Windy Bay and some other places on the Charlottes must be left in their natural condition so that we could keep our identity and pass it on to the following generations. And a forest like that, the ocean, and those things are what keep us as Haida people today.
So if they're logged on?
If they're logged off, we probably end up the same as everyone else, I guess.
In a matter of months, all of this could be gone. At the top of the hills, a logging company is poised to sweep into the valley. This moonscape was once like Windy Bay, and like Windy Bay, it too was part of Tree Farm License Number 24, the permit that will allow Western Forest Products Limited to conduct the same kind of clear-cut logging in the watershed.
So this is where the Haida had decided to draw the line. It's 6,000 hectares, and the forest company was given permission by the government to log right up to the top of the mountains here and right down into the valley to the very edge of the river. This is a salmon-bearing river. The Haida have a longhouse behind these trees here, and they had decided they were going to block the road and not allow the trucks to come in, and I decided that I would join them and protest against that logging. So the line was drawn here, and I was amazed to discover this unbelievable culture right in my province, and I didn't know anything about it. This is Gu Zhao, who we did the interview with in the video, and I decided that I would go. Everybody was prepared to go and get arrested by blockading the road, and I said I'll go along and get arrested too. And when the CBC heard that I was in Haida Gwaii, in these islands, prepared to get arrested, they called me and said, if you get arrested, we'll pull you off the air and we'll probably cancel the series. So the Nature of Things had been running since 1960. I had just joined it in 1979. This is in the early 80s. There's no way I could jeopardize the show by getting arrested. And I felt very frustrated because I wanted to go and show solidarity. And my dad stepped in and said, well, I've got the same name as you. I'll get arrested in your place. So this is Dad. He's up on the beach at Windy Bay. He was, I think, 73 or 74, perfectly relaxed and ready to get arrested. And I was freaked out because I didn't want my father to end up going to jail. And fortunately, about 20 Haida ended up getting arrested. And Dad didn't have to because the government gave in. And they not only saved Windy Bay, but all the rest of the island south, 144 acres of wilderness, is now a park a part of Guayanas National Park Reserve forever. And that was a great victory. This is Miles Richardson, the president of the Haida Nation, celebrating with the minister, federal minister of the environment. It was a great, great victory for everybody. Because Tara, my wife and I, were swept up fighting with the Haida, First Nations people all across Canada began to bombard us with requests to help them. And so we ended up fighting with people like the Innu in Labrador, who were fighting against NATO low-level jet flights that were just scaring their caribou, and the Cree in Quebec. We fought and stopped a big dam being built on one of their rivers, and the Lubicon in Alberta were fighting against Daisho, a Japanese company, logging their territory, and the Gwich'in in Yukon, who are fighting to this very day, the Bush government now, that's going to go in and drill in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, ANWR, which is the calving grounds of the porcupine caribou herd. So, and one of the first groups to contact us were the Lilwat people in British Columbia, who were fighting to protect the Stein Valley. And they said, we would like to have a great celebration every summer, and if we can get enough people coming to these celebrations of the Stein, the government will not be able to log it. So they asked me to help, and the first thing I did was call this guy. And this is John Denver. And John, I don't know how, but he knew who I was. And when I told him the story, he agreed immediately to come, and he flew his own plane. This is Cassandra, an Australian girl who was his girlfriend. And he married her and divorced her. But they flew up, and it was wonderful. Thousands of Canadians came up to this concert for John. And then we had Gordon Lightfoot and Buffy St. Marie and Bruce Coburn and Norman Jewison came to one and gave us $5,000 from him in share. It was, and after 5 or 6 years, 35,000 Canadians came up to celebrate the Stein Valley, and I knew right away they'll never log it. And a few years later, it became a provincial park. So that was another great victory that we got to celebrate. This is I just wanted to show you because it's a spectacular shot. These are the First Nations in BC are they're ocean people. And the tradition used to be that they would meet every year. They would paddle their canoes to different villages and have a great gathering. And that's where the males would meet females in the village. And it was a big social thing. Hadn't had a canoe gathering for 100 years. And the Hiltzik people in Bella Bella decided to have a canoe gathering and asked the nations up and down the coast to build a canoe and paddle it there. And Tara and I got to go. And this is what greeted each canoe as it came in, were these spectacular dancers in their blankets with their various totems. This is a raven and this is an eagle, and sewn on these button blankets, and the buttons are made of mother of pearl and abalone shell. And it's just to me it's a demonstration of the vibrant culture that still exists in British Columbia. One of the things that they do when you go to their event, their celebrations and potlatches and feasts, is they make you dance. And this is something I find very hard. This is me here. They get you all dressed up in their regalia, and then they start drumming, and you have to. And I always feel that I'm a crummy dancer. But the thing I found is, it's not how well you dance, but the fact that you get up and dance, that they really appreciate that you honor them by doing it. My Tara, on the other hand, loves to do it. Gets up at the drop of a hat and dances away. But women's dances are easier than men's dances. So we've had a lot of experiences with Aboriginal people in Canada, but also in other areas. This is in 1989, Tara and my first visit to Ayers Rock, or what's called Uluru, and we met this Aboriginal woman, and she asked if she could take us around the rock, and we were delighted. And I thought, my God, what a godforsaken desert this is. And within minutes, she had gathered all kinds of little plants and insects that were either medicines or food. And again, this amazing illustration of the richness of cultures around the world. And the knowledge that she had of the area, of course, is thousands of years old. And when they die out, we'll never get that knowledge back through science. It's a great tragedy of our times, is all of these ancient cultures that are going extinct so rapidly, and with it the knowledge. A few years later, when I was doing film The Sacred Balance, we applied to the Aboriginal in Arnhem Land, which is the northern part of Australia. This is totally under Aboriginal control, and you have to apply to get permission to go, and we applied and got permission to go to Numbelwar, which is a native community, and no white person had ever seen this dance or filmed it, and they allowed us to film it for The Nature of Things, one of the great, or for Sacred Balance, one of my great experiences. Papua New Guinea used to be colonized by Australia, and because of that, PNG and Australia still have very close relationships. And unknown to me, many of the shows I did in Australia were broadcast in Papua New Guinea. And so I was invited to go to Port Moresby in Papua New Guinea, and I did. This is in the early 1990s. And when I got off the plane, I was met by these two spectacular dancers who met me on the tarmac, and then they began to drum and dance. And they drummed me into the airport, right past customs, didn't say a word, right out onto the street and into a car, and off I went. It was a great way to be welcomed into PNG. And they flew me all over the country into these very isolated areas, and one of them was Kokoda. Kokoda, I didn't know, there's a trail that goes right across the island, the Kokoda Trail, and that's where the Japanese were coming during World War II to come across the Papua New Guinea so they could get a leg in Port Moresby and then attack Australia. And Australian troops then met the Japanese, and it was a ferocious battle. They slaughtered thousands of Japanese, and I don't know how many thousand Australians were killed, but they stopped them. So Kokoda was very, very important, and I was met here at the head of the Kokoda Trail by these people, and I knew they'd been cannibals only two or three generations ago. It was very, very intimidating, but they welcomed me like a long-lost friend, and I had these wonderful experiences with... They weren't hungry that time. So, great experiences. I have lots of adventures there, but I won't share. When I was a child, I always dreamed of going to what I call the three big A's. Africa, Australia, and the Amazon. And I got to go to Africa in the '70s. I got to Australia in 1988. And in 1988... The Nature of Things decided to do a film on the Amazon. And so in August of 88, I flew down to Brazil for 2 months of filming. So I wanted to do part of the film. It was a two-hour special on the natives that had been fighting to protect their land. I'm sorry this is out of focus, but it's the only picture I have of my first meeting with this man. His name is Payakan, and he's a Kayapo Indian. And Payakan had fought against gold mines successfully in his territory. And so he allowed us to come into his village and film in Aukri. And while I was filming with him, he said, I have discovered that Brazil has a plan called Plano 2010 to build a series of giant dams on all the major rivers flowing into the Amazon. And one of them was the Xingu River, where his territory was, and it was going to flood the entire forest of the Kayapo people. And they hadn't even told the Indians this was going to happen. And the World Bank had already offered a $500 million loan for Brazil to get started. And he said, I want to stop these dams. Will you help me? And I said, well, what do you need? He said, I need money. So I did what I always do when I get involved with people like this. As soon as I got out of his village to a telephone, I called my wife. And I said, Payakan's willing to come to Canada, do something. And she organized two huge events in Toronto and Ottawa. Thousands of people came. We raised $70,000. And the Minister of Finance told me he got more mail from Canadians telling him not to vote for this loan that the World Bank was going to make. To Brazil. So Canadians responded tremendously to Payakan coming. Payakan said, I'm going to take this money, buy a boat, go up and down the Xingu River and invite all of the native tribes to come to Altamira where the dam was going to be built, and we'll have a big demonstration. And so Tara and I decided we wanted to go down to the demonstration, and she ended up studying Portuguese so that she could, she was fluent in Portuguese. We went, ended up taking 40 Canadians and going down to the gathering. And this is one of the guys that came with us. His name is Gordon Lightfoot. And Gord is, was just, he's supported Tara and me for years and years. And he came down with us, and he was just a wonderful, wonderful guy to have on the trip. When we got there, Sting arrived. And Sting was a good friend of this man here. He's a Kayapo Indian as well. You can, his name is Hawani, and you recognize him right away because he's got that big librette in his lower lip. And this is Payakan, my friend, who masterminded this whole event. This is a press conference. There are Indians from the Amazon. You can tell they have different headdresses here. This is Simon Dick, who's a Canadian Indian, from Kwakwaka'wakw Indian. This is an Iroquois Indian from the United States. And this is, if you've ever watched TV and saw the, seen the ads for Lakota Medicine, this is Red Crow, who's the guy that advertises Lakota Medicine on television. So it was a great gathering of all these people protesting against the dam. And the meeting took place for 3 days in this big building. And all around the edge of the building, on the inside of the walls, were hundreds of soldiers armed with machine guns and rifles. And then this is the table where the speakers sat. And down on the dirt floor were hundreds of Indians from more than 30 different tribes along the Xingu River. They're as different as the English are from the Germans. I mean, each tribe was very different. And look at the headdresses. You can tell from the headdresses they come from different tribes. And then around, in a horseshoe around the Indians were hundreds of environmentalists like us and press from around the world. So this is where the meeting went on. This is a very, very dramatic moment. This man is the representative of Eletro Norte, the company that was going to build the dams. And he had just given a speech in which he had said to the Indians, I'm sorry, we forgot to tell you we're going to build a dam to flood your territory, but Brazil needs the energy and the money. Don't worry, we'll find you a forest somewhere else and we'll give you money. So there's always a standard thing. If we can't replace what you've got, we'll give you money. And this woman is a Kayapo Indian. She had stood up in front of these men here, facing them. She said, this man just told you he's going to build a dam and flood our territory. You guys call yourselves warriors, and not one of you got up and killed him. What kind of warriors are you? And she pulled out her machete, and with the flat of the blade, slapped him on the face like that. And right away, the rifles came up. And it was the most terrifying moment of my life. I signaled to my wife, I said, hit the floor. There's no way we can get out of here. Cover your head and pray they don't shoot. And I really thought they were going to shoot her and a few other people. And Payakan then leapt up, and this is when the picture was taken. And by sheer force of his charisma, he got the soldiers to put the guns down, and everybody calmed down. He said, look, this is theater. She didn't mean anything. And as soon as the guns came down, I ran out to the bathroom to clean out my underwear. That was the most frightening experience of my life. But this went on for 3 days. At the end of the third day, the World Bank canceled its loan. And to this day, not a single dam has been built. One of the great victories of thousands of people. And it all started because of Payakan. What a brilliant guy. But in Brazil, they kill Indians like dogs. They never have to worry about getting arrested. We interviewed for our special, we interviewed a rubber tapper named Chico Mendes. 2 weeks after we interviewed him, he was assassinated. So Payakan began to get death threats every day. And we said, the last day of the meeting, we said, what can we do to protect your life? And he said, well, Brazilians get really excited, but they forget quickly. The best thing is for me to get out of the country and let him calm down. So he said, great, what do you want to do? He said, I want to go to Vancouver and stay with you and Tara. So a couple of days later, here's Tara in the Vancouver airport greeting Payakan and his wife. This is Irakran. She was only 22 years old. And this is Mayao, their youngest baby. And Irakran never smiled. And she was fierce as could be. When she said, Davi, I came running over. What do you want? What do you want? Like, she scared the hell out of me. And Irakran and the girls only spoke Kayapo. Payakan spoke Kayapo and Portuguese. Tara spoke Portuguese and English. So Payakan and Tara did all of the communicating. I love this picture. This is our youngest daughter, Sirika, and Payakan's oldest daughter, Oe. This is Tanya, his middle daughter. And they didn't speak a word of each other's languages. They got along like gangbusters. We had a lovely apartment in our basement, and the Paikon and his family moved down there. We took him up Grouse Mountain. They had never seen snow. The girls absolutely loved it. This is Tanya and my older daughter, Severn. Paikon hated snow. He sat in the car the whole time, wouldn't look at us, just sat there smoking cigarettes. I'm sure thinking, when the hell are they going to get in here so we can get out of here? And we took them all over British Columbia to meet First Nations people, and it was very moving. This is in a village called Alert Bay, the Kwakwaka'wakw people, and everywhere they went, they would be greeted like long-lost brothers and sisters, and people would say, your people are going through what our ancestors went through 150 years ago, and very poor communities, and they gave them thousands of dollars to support their battle. So they had been in our house for 3 weeks when Irakron came upstairs, and she said, Davi, Tara! So we came running over there. What do you want? So translated through Paikon, she said, I've been here 3 weeks. It's cold in your country. I miss my mother and father. My children should be studying with the elders. But I came here because you said you'd buy me an airplane. Now, where's my airplane? We're going, what the hell is she talking about? And we tried to piece it together. And when Paikon was threatened in Brazil, the last night we had, one of the ideas was we could set up a bank account in Hedin Sao, the nearest town, and we'll buy him a radio phone so he could stay in Owl Creek, the village where he was safe. And if he had to go out for politics or whatever, he could phone the bank and they would charter a plane and send it in. She thought I said, we'll buy him an airplane. Well, the next week I had to go to England to give a speech. So I, as soon as I got to London, I called a friend of mine, a woman named Anita Roddick. Anita had organized a very successful company called The Body Shop. And I knew that Anita had met Paikon. So I called her. I said, Anita, Paikon says he needs an airplane. Can you help me out? And she wrote me a check for 100,000 US. Meanwhile, back in Vancouver, Tara had found there were all kinds of websites for used airplanes. So she downloaded all of these pictures and specs of these planes. I get back to Vancouver, and this most incredible memory, sitting on the couch with Irakron on one side, Paikon on the other, flipping through these pictures, and Irakron going, oh, that looks like a nice airplane. Oh, I like that one, you know, knowing nothing about airplanes. Anyway, we ended up, Tara found a plane, Cessna Utility 206, for anybody that knows about planes. That's this plane here in Galveston, Texas. And she found this man here, Al Johnson. And Al lives in Vancouver, but he's a pilot for American Airlines. And Tara knew that Al had flown in his spare time for Greenpeace and had flown Brigitte Bardot to the ice fields of Newfoundland to protest the sealing operation there. So she called Al, told him the story. He said, great. And he said, I'll go down and check it out. And he flew on his own time at his own expense, flew to Galveston, flew the plane, called us and said, great buy, $50,000. We bought it, sent him the $100,000. He pulled the back seat out of the plane and put special tanks in. And at the height of hurricane season, he flew across the Caribbean, hip-hopping from island to island to avoid the hurricanes, all the way to Brazil, all the way to Aokri. And for 2 months, he stayed in Aokri and flew the plane for Paikon. I mean, nobody in Canada knows the story, but to me, Al Johnson is this amazing hero. So anyway, after we got the plane, of course, Irakron was all smiles and she was happy. And 6 weeks later, Paikon said, I think it's safe to go home. So when we took him to the airport, to our shock, Irakron began to wail. And this is their traditional way of saying I'm sad. And said, please, please come to Aokri and visit us so we can pay you back. So right on the spot, we decided, let's go down to Aokri. And 4 months later, we went down. Severn was 9 and Sarika was 5. And we flew. Now, to get from Hedin Sao, the nearest town, to Aokri by canoe would have taken us 14 days. It's way the hell in the Amazon. But we'd bought him a plane and now they had a little airstrip. This strut is the strut of the plane that we had bought for them. We flew in. This is 200 people living in these huts. This is Paikon's hut. This is where we stayed. But we spent most of our time in the river and swimming because it was so hot in the daytime. And the women would catch piranhas in here, which we ate. And they would get their fresh water from the side of the bank. And we stayed for 2 glorious weeks in the heart of the Amazon. So here's Severin and Sarika meeting their long-lost friends, Oe and Tanya. About 4 days after we got there, they had a special festa, a celebration. Not for us, it was just there. And we couldn't believe it. This is Oe and Tanya. Look at the spectacular outfit. And the women were dressed with racks made of branches with feathers just going above their head. It was absolutely spectacular. And we had to, every day we had to go out and gather food, of course, no electricity or anything. And this day we went, and this is about 6 feet long. It's an electric eel. And this is Mokuka, Paikon's cousin, is killing another one. They only took two, and they took very great care not to touch them because they said that they could hurt, if Karo, the six-year-old, had touched it when they were alive, it could deliver quite a wallop. So we had this wonderful time then, living as people lived 10,000 years ago, every day going out hunting and gathering, and the girls wept when we had to leave 2 weeks later. But 12 years later, I got to go back down again and visit, and the village was still there and still the same, and the plane was still there. And Irukron said, "You've got to let me paint you." So she did, and I said, "How long will the paint last?" She said, "Oh, 7 or 8 days." Well, it lasted 30 days. And every time I went to the gym in Vancouver, took off my shirt. But here's Irukron, I felt, had really aged since we saw her in 12 years. This is Mayao, who was the baby that came to Vancouver. This is Tanya, the middle daughter, and this is Irumong, their last child, a son. And Paikon has decided that he's going to continue the battle through his children. And he said, "I want my daughters to go to university. Would you help me?" So Tara and I set up a fund, and we've been paying money to send the girls to university. Unfortunately, as soon as Oe, the eldest girl, got to university, she got pregnant by a white guy who abandoned her. And then Tanya went 2 years later, and she got pregnant. So they're both single mothers now. I'm almost sure they're not going to make it through. It's just too hard to be an Indian going to a Brazilian university trying to make it with a kid. So now Paikon has gotten in touch with me, and he wants Mayao to come and live in my house and go to the University of British Columbia. I guess I'm supposed to say, "Don't come near her till she graduates." I'm quite honestly, I'm not very keen on it, but Tara is very, very keen. So if history is any precedent, I guess we're going to end up taking Mayao into our house for 4 years so she can go to UBC. When we left Aokri in 1989, we knew that there were a lot of problems in the world that Tara and I couldn't just fight in a helter-skelter way. So we started a foundation, the David Suzuki Foundation, to carry on a more directed battle. This is a science-based organization that is looking for solutions that we will communicate to the Canadian public. Oops, what happened there? And Tara immediately resigned her position at Harvard to become the unpaid volunteer president of the organization. When we were leaving Aokri in 1989, Severn became very upset when we passed over a gold mine and then some burning in the forest. So she got back to Vancouver and started a club called ECHO, the Environmental Children's Organization. They would go to schools and give little talks about why the forest is important and why we should support the people that live in the forest. And in 1991, when she was 11, she came to me. She said, "Dad, I hear there's going to be a big meeting in Brazil next year. Are you going?" I said, "No." She said, "Well, I'm going to take ECHO, her club." And I said, "Well, it's going to cost a lot of money and it's going to be polluted. And why do you want to go?" And she said, "I think all these grown-ups are going to make decisions about that are going to affect us. And they're not even going to think about us. And I think we should go to be their conscience." So I said, "Okay, well, why don't you see how much you can raise? And if you raise," I thought, you know, they're going to have bake sales and all this. "If you can raise, every dollar you raise, Mummy and I will match it. So see how much money you can raise." Bad idea. Don't ever do this. She then went out and raised $14,000. And the next thing you knew, in 1992, when she was 12, she took down, this is ECHO, her little gang. This is Tara, and this is a guy that helped make it possible. He's a very renowned singer in Canada called Raffi. He's a children's singer. And Raffi, when he heard about it, immediately gave her $4,000 and said, "I'm going to come down and sing for you," and he did. So they rented a booth at the Global Forum, and they had newspapers that they had printed in Vancouver, and the girls spoke French, Spanish, and English. And very soon, a television crew came from Japan, and then one from England, one from Canada. And before you know it, Severin was invited to give a speech in front of the entire audience.
We're a group of 12 and 13-year-olds trying to make a difference. Vanessa Setti, Morgan Geisler, Michelle Quigg, and me. We've raised all the money to come here ourselves, to come 5,000 miles to tell you adults you must change your ways. Coming up here today, I have no hidden agenda. I am fighting for my future. Losing my future is not like losing an election, or a few points on the stock market. I am here to speak for all generations to come. I am here to speak on behalf of the starving children around the world whose cries go unheard. I am here to speak for the countless animals dying across this planet because they have nowhere left to go. I am afraid to go out in the sun now because of the holes in our ozone. I'm afraid to breathe the air because I don't know what chemicals are in it. I used to go fishing in Vancouver, my home, with my dad, until just a few years ago we found the fish full of cancers. And now we hear of animals and plants going extinct, every day vanishing forever. In my life, I have dreamt of seeing the great herds of wild animals, jungles and rainforests full of birds and butterflies, but now I wonder if they will even exist for my children to see. Did you have to worry of these things when you were my age? All this is happening before our eyes, and yet we act as if we have all the time we want and all the solutions. I'm only a child, and I don't have all the solutions. But I want you to realize, neither do you. You don't know how to fix the holes in our ozone layer. You don't know how to bring the salmon back up in a dead stream. You don't know how to bring back an animal now extinct. And you can't bring back the forest that once grew where there is now a desert. If you don't know how to fix it, please stop breaking it. Here, you may be delegates of your government, business people, organizers, reporters, or politicians, but really, your mothers and fathers, sisters and brothers, aunts and uncles, and all of you are someone's child. I'm only a child, yet I know we are all part of a family, 5 billion strong, in fact, 30 million species strong. And borders and governments will never change that. I'm only a child, yet I know we are all in this together and should act as one single world towards one single goal. In my anger, I am not blind, and in my fear, I am not afraid of telling the world how I feel. In my country, we make so much waste. We buy and throw away, buy and throw away, buy and throw away, and yet northern countries will not share with the needy. Even when we have more than enough, we are afraid to share. We are afraid to let go of some of our wealth. In Canada, we live the privileged life, with plenty of food, water, and shelter. We have watches, bicycles, computers, and telephone sets. The list could go on for 2 days. 2 days ago, here in Brazil, we were shocked when we spent time with some children living on the streets. This is what one child told us. I wish I was rich. And if I were, I would give all the street children food, clothes, medicines, shelter, and love and affection. If a child on the streets who has nothing is willing to share, why are we who have everything still so greedy? I can't stop thinking that these are children my own age, that it makes a tremendous difference where you are born. That I could be one of those children living in the favelas of Rio. I could be a child starving in Somalia, or a victim of war in the Middle East, or a beggar in India. I am only a child, yet I know if all the money spent on war was spent on finding environmental answers, ending poverty, and finding treaties, what a wonderful place this earth would be. At school, even in kindergarten, you teach us how to behave in the world. You teach us to not to fight with others, to work things out, to respect others, to clean up our mess, not to hurt other creatures, to share, not be greedy. Then why do you go out and do the things you tell us not to do? Do not forget why you're attending these conferences, who you're doing this for. We are your own children. You are deciding what kind of a world you are growing up in. Parents should be able to comfort their children by saying, everything's going to be all right. It's not the end of the world. And we're doing the best we can. But I don't think you can say that to us anymore. Are we even on your list of priorities? My dad always says, you are what you do, not what you say. Well, what you do makes me cry at night. You grown-ups say you love us, but I challenge you, please, make your actions reflect your words. Thank you.
She came back after the talk and sat with us, and this guy jumped up and ran over, shook her hands, and said, that's the best speech anybody gave at this entire meeting. This is Al Gore. Aww. I met Al last year at a dinner for him. I was giving a toast to him, and someone took this picture. He greeted me like this long-lost friend, and it was because I was Severin's dad, I'm sure. Anyway, these are just a few vignettes from a life. I'm not going to save the world. My foundation's not going to save the world. But I believe that millions and millions of people and thousands of organizations trying to do our little bit can become an irresistible force. So thank you very much. How long was it, Allison? 10 minutes too long. Oh, yes. Well, Severin, the one that gave the speech, is 27. She graduated from Yale in biology and is now getting a master's in ethnobotany, which is how native people use plants. And before she's going to take a year out and then go on for a PhD. And the youngest one graduated from Berkeley just in June and is now starting a PhD in marine biology at UBC. The other set is Tomiko, the one that was a baby in that shot. She graduated from McGill University in biology and is now works in a chromosome lab at Sick Children's. My son is a filmmaker and lives up in Yukon. And the other daughter graduated from Queen's University and is she and her husband write and illustrate children's books. So they're my great contribution to the planet. Thank you all. Thank you.